Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 219. A new governor is about to sail into Table Bay. Sir Philip Edmund Wodehouse, born in 1811, eldest child of Edmund Wodehouse, who married his first cousin Lucy, daughter of Philip Wodehouse, Uncle Philip to Sir Philip Edmund. How very Victorian. Queen Victoria herself married her first cousin Prince Albert. She allowed and even encouraged cousin marriage, particularly amongst royalty and the upper classes, to consolidate power, property and lineage. But it also increased the risk of birth defects by 2%. And if both parents carry a recessive gene mutation, their child has a 25% chance of expressing the disorder. Scientists have a well-worn phrase for this. It's called inbreeding. Wodehouse Jr. entered the Ceylon Civil Service in 1828 and was installed as superintendent of British Honduras between 1851 and 54. From there, he sailed to British Guyana, where he served as governor between 1854 and 1861, before heading to the Cape in 1862. Let's spend a little bit of time touching on Sir Philip Wodehouse's disastrous moments in British Guyana. 2 years after he took office in the South American country, the Angel Gabriel riots broke out. His implacable opponent was John Sayers Orr, whose nom de guerre was the Angel Gabriel. He was half Scottish, half African. Edinburgh's Caledonian newspaper of the time reported that his mother, Mary Ann Orr, was a respectable coloured woman and married to a respectable Scot, John Orr Sr. Some have whispered she was a freed slave. She appears to have been a fiercely independent woman who others learned not to cross. Perhaps that accounts for her son's character, which, as you'll hear, was fiercely fierce. John Sayers Orr was rabidly anti-papal, hated the Pope, and had an anti-Catholic obsession. He took to the Guyanese streets with bullhorn in hand, whereupon the distant Glasgow Herald noted he spoke rampant anti-papist froth and lies. The future Angel Gabriel was an interesting character. First arrested in London in 1832, then again in 1848. Short while later, he was arrested in Montreal, Canada. He says the folks of this time didn't get around. Between 1850 and 1851, he popped up in Boston, then New York, Bath in Maine, and Manchester in New Hampshire. In 1854, he was hustled off by police in Boston. Apart from the usual racial insults leveled at him, the Boston police report says he had more impudence than brains. Who, with a three-cornered hat and a cockade on his head, an old brass horn, took the advantage of the political excitement, travelled around the city, tooting his horn, collecting crowds in the streets, delivering what he called his political lectures, and passing around the hat for contributions. Sounds like a modern political influencer. Bullhorn, disinformation, the extreme rhetoric, not to mention his hat, which is literally crowdsourcing. He was arrested at least 20 times for what was called his international harangues tour, where he had shot confusing messages to people like, "Scorn be those who rob us of our rights. Purgatory for popery and the Pope. Freedom to man, be he black or white. Rule Britannia." Shouting "Rule Britannia" in Boston must have taken some guts. No wonder he was flung into jail. Bizarrely, the resonances to today's crazy politics continued. Orr was associated with a fantastically named Know-Nothing Party in America. Wait till you hear about this bunch. You'll recognize bits of modern USA. Members of that movement were required to say, "I know nothing," whenever they were asked about its specifics, its policies, by outsiders, and that provided the group with its colloquial name, the Know-Nothing Party. Before you wonder aloud what relevance all this has, let me quickly point out that the so-called Know-Nothing Party had 43 representatives in Congress at the height of its power in the late 1850s. It started out as the Native American Party, then was renamed the American Party. The Know-Nothings were an old-stock nativist political movement who believed that an alleged Romanist conspiracy to subvert civil and religious liberty in the U.S. was being hatched by Catholics. the deep state of the time. Everyone needs a deep state to deal with their own deficiencies. Therefore, they sought to politically organize native-born Protestants in defense of their traditional religious and political values. The Know Nothing movement is remembered for this theme because Protestants feared the Catholic priests and bishops would control a large block of voters. In most places, the ideology and influence of the Know Nothing movement lasted only 1 or 2 years before it disintegrated due to weak and inexperienced local leaders, a lack of publicly proclaimed national leaders, and a deep split over the issue of slavery. In parts of the South, for example, the party did not emphasize anti-Catholicism as frequently as the members in the North, and the Southerners stressed a neutral position on slavery. But in the South, it was the main opposition party to the Democratic Party. When the American Party collapsed just before the Civil War, most of the Know-Nothings, yes, joined the Republican Party. In a nutshell, our hero, the mixed African Scots John Sayers Orr, had an ideology that can be described as a unique blend of egalitarianism, anti-Catholicism, and British imperialism. Ye gads! How odd! In 1855, this strange 19th century character pitched up in British Guyana, and Sir Philip Wodehouse had his work cut out. Soon Orr was up to his old tricks, walking about with his bullhorn, carrying a flag and a British imperial badge, followed by a group of, well, followers. They were not repeating they knew nothing, but attacked the British establishment. Needless to say, Wodehouse was out of his depth. In February 1856, Orr gathered his fellow Orr's men and women in the main market and mounted the town water pump, armed with a dagger and a life preserver. Yes, a life jacket. I mean, this is one nutty picture. But Mr. Orr, like many modern extremist digital media aficionados, knew how to whip up a crowd and used physical props excellently, along with direct messaging. A knife in one hand, bullhorn in the other, wearing a life jacket. It worked. 1,000 people surrounded Orr. The authorities were nervous. Orr verbally abused the Portuguese immigrants, who he claimed had come to Guyana to drive Creole businessmen out. That went too far. The British regarded the Portuguese as European, you know, and Orr was arrested. The governor's response was heavy-handed. Wodehouse set bail at £500, which is about £14,000 today. And the governor made things worse when he called Guyanese women the most vicious and savage class of the community. Riots broke out, spreading across Guyana. Wodehouse panicked. He called for support from all surrounding British colonies. Even the Dutch and the French helped. So Wodehouse, ever the subtle man of the time, then imposed a huge poll tax as reparations for the losses suffered by Portuguese merchants. That was a tax levied on every adult in the population. Meanwhile, John Sayers Orr died in a penal colony. Wodehouse would pay a price for all this madness. His entourage were the first and last to be publicly stoned in Guyana, and I don't mean they passed around a bong. A crowd of 3,000 gathered as his ship was about to leave for a short visit abroad in 1857. The enraged crowd flung all manner of offal, plantain stalks and stones at the governor, hitting his poor wife on the forehead, slicing open the ear of the chief justice and wounding a bishop. Anti-papists would have been in raptures. Forgive my somewhat lengthy introduction to Sir Philip Wodehouse, but it's important because in 1862, this man arrived in Table Bay, the new Cape Governor. This cousin of Lord Kimberley replaced Sir George Grey officially in January 1862. Apart from an authoritarian streak, which all governors needed in order to govern, he was decisive. Just to confound things a little, he was going to be more humane as a governor in Africa. Perhaps he'd learned his lesson in Guyana. He needed persistence and tact to deal with the Cape, where the split between the Westerners and the Easterners was growing more pronounced. Western Cape versus Eastern Cape, if you remember. His greatest local sparring partners were John Charles Maltino and Saul Solomon. They were pressing for the Cape to advance to full responsible government, while the Easterners, led by Robert Godlinton, yes, that old editor of the Grahamstown Journal, were resisting the handing of power to the Westerners. A prudent financial policy appeared impossible, and Wodehouse was trapped between the Easterners and Westerners and between his masters in London and his local legislators. The Treasury had told him that the subsidies in British Kaffraria could not be allowed to continue. The Colonial Office could also not fully explain how the Cape, with less than 4% of the British colonial population, was gobbling up more than 25% of all colonial military expenditure. It made sense for British Kaffraria to be annexed to the Cape, but the Cape Parliament knew a hospital pass when they saw one and refused to accept the responsibility and the expense. Their narrative, foisted on us over the years, folks, was that the colonials just wanted to seize land willy-nilly and non-stop, but the Cape legislators of 1862 were loath to take over more land when it cost a pretty penny to run it. The Cape establishment of the time could be divided roughly into five categories: military, professional, bureaucratic, landed, mercantile. Soldiers, lawyers, magistrates, farmers, traders. The military elite were mostly English officers who were also a periodic elite, moving on to the next posting or retiring. Some retired in the Cape, most did not. The professional elite were generally educated abroad. They were trained in the liberal arts, which doesn't have the same meaning we use today. These were lawyers, barristers, solicitors, doctors, clergy, academics, teachers, engineers, architects, and pharmacists, as well as land surveyors. They were also morphing into the next category, the bureaucratic elite, technocrats in the fledgling government, the top policymakers, for all of whom the Cape was really a limited sphere in terms of career opportunities. Wealth determined position and influence. It was accepted in the Cape, as it was in Britain, that land ownership conferred status, and these folks led the list of occupations in the first Cape Parliament. But unlike Britain, where the big landowners were still the most influential social class of the 1860s, in the Cape, the burgeoning, urban, mainly British-born mercantile capitalists formed the apex of the social pyramid. It's important to understand these elites and how they were going to affect South Africa's history in profound ways. The fifth group of elites, the mercantile capitalists, were individuals or firms who invested in and profited from commerce, particularly the buying and selling of goods, rather than producing them directly. They were businessmen and a sprinkling of women who operated within or controlled parts of the trade networks that linked raw materials, labor, and markets. Things like financing shipping, organizing supply chains, speculating on prices, running warehouses or trade agencies, diversifying in everything from fabric and firearms to coffee and opium, lending cash to entrepreneurs. Though intellectually less progressive than the professional class, they possessed that crucial colonial status symbol, high-profile wealth, which gave them legitimacy as a ruling elite. Mercantile capitalists in the 1860s were the engines of empire-era commerce, funding trade, managing global supply chains, speculating on the prices, weaving together the markets of Europe, Asia, and Africa. They didn't make goods. They moved them, stored them, sold them, and made money off every step. Let's take a look at a few examples. Thomson, Watson & Co., a well-known merchant house in Cape Town during the mid-19th century. They dealt in wool exports, wine, whale oil, ivory, and manufactured British goods. By maintaining relationships with inland farmers and local producers, Thomson, Watson & Co. acted as middlemen, purchasing raw materials and shipping them to London or Liverpool for resale. Other examples were the Mosenthal brothers, a powerful firm founded by Adolf Mosenthal in the 1830s, influential by the 1860s. The company began operations in Graaf Reinet, expanded to Port Elizabeth and Cape Town, and were one of the major players in the wool trade, South Africa's most profitable export at the time. One of the brothers, Joseph Mosenthal, was active in Natal as well. His company had offices in Durban and Pietermaritzburg, and they sold sugar, hides, and made Indian indentured labor arrangements. The Mosenthal brothers set up a network of agents and stores across the Eastern Cape and the Karoo to collect wool from farmers, and they profited both from exporting wool and importing goods like clothing, tools, and food. Then how about Barrow and Co., a Cape Town-based trading company that dealt in timber and grain and provisions. Like others, they extended credit to local businesses and government agencies, acting as a kind of informal bank. In Simonstown was De Pas, Spence & Co., originally involved in whaling and shipping, then diversifying into general trade, including the export of guano as fertilizer. Samuel Bailey, who operated in Port Elizabeth, became one of the leading wool buyers in the Eastern Cape, particularly during the boom. Bailey was one of the main Easterners who were going to make Wodehouse's life difficult when it came to building new railway lines. The merchants of the mid-19th century Cape weren't just traders. They were the architects of financial modernity. They built shipping networks with ledgers and banks out of barrels. The wool they packed in dusty warehouses would begin to finance railroads, fund city development, and underpin entire empires. Some became bankers, others became insurers, and a few, like the Mosenthals, became global traders with offices from Hamburg to Hobart. By the late 19th century, they had branches in the UK, Germany, and Australia. South Africa's companies continued to thrive in the global marketplace from here on. Take De Pas and Spence of Simonstown, which would end up merging with a major shipping company of the age, the Union Castle Line. We must mention Old Mutual, founded in 1845 as the Mutual Life Assurance Society of the Cape of Good Hope. Originally set up as a simple burial society for the professional class, those lawyers, clergy, merchants, and so on, early shareholders included prominent mercantile families like the Mosenthals. By the 1860s, Old Mutual was issuing policies to shipping firms and offering marine insurance for wool consignments, growing into a pan-African and international insurance and asset firm. The South African Mutual Life Assurance Society was a parallel stream, drawing on merchant capital. It extended services to professionals and upper-middle-class settlers. These institutions offered risk coverage for sea trade, wagons, livestock, and property. Insurance in South Africa had begun quite literally on the high seas in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Cape Town's strategic port status created an excellent constant trade in cargo and higher risk and the need for protection. As the early port cities of South Africa grew, so too did the risks of urban fires and property damage. By the 1860s, local firms began offering building insurance, often underwritten by British companies like the Royal Insurance Company, but with offices in South Africa. Early insurance in the Cape and the rest of South Africa was elitist and selective, access restricted to a small group of white settlers, merchants, professionals, and government officials. Policies were handwritten, risk was assessed through local networks, and claims were far more arbitrary than they even are today. And yet, these services laid the foundations for the modern financial security systems we use, the growth of actuarial science, the eventual emergence of a host of national insurers, state-backed pension funds, and banks. Next episode, we'll scour the horizon and begin covering what became known as the Transvaal Civil War, where Boer was going to fight Boer. It would end with a peace treaty signed under a Kriya tree in Brits in 1864. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm loading updates about episodes. You can email me from there too. Until next, goodbye.